I'll try to mention the guy's dad, and then if you don't have a lot to say about.
Who's that?
Just Hall of Famers, the guys that you've coached.
Oh, the ones I've coached?
Yeah. But I also might just ask you if you anything, you know, anything to say about any of the guys that were on the other side of the ball also.
Yeah, okay.
Like some other future Hall of Famers on that team on the offensive side, you know.
Okay. I'm Wade Phillips.
And I'm Wes Phillips. We're past and present coaches here to bring you an insider's perspective on the teams, the people, and the personalities that we've encountered over time.
Today we thought we would dive into some of the Hall of Fame players that that you've coached throughout the years and some of the stories I know you've got on many of these guys. Probably going to take some time to get through with the number of guys that in a 42-year career in the NFL that you've ended up coming across and coaching. Just digging right into it, starting off with the Houston Oilers way back when. I mean, right off the bat, your first year in the NFL, now you're directly coaching in your first 2 years. You know, you've got Robert Brazil, Elvin Bethea, and Curly Culp, who were all future Hall of Famers.
Right. I went in with the Oilers, 27 years old. I'm coaching Brazil, and then I coached Elvin and Curly. I thought I was a heck of a coach. I mean, everything you'd tell them to do, they could do. You know, I'd say, well, you do this, and they could do it. And they'd say, you do this, you could do it. And I found out later on that not all the players you're going to coach could do those things. So when I went to other places, I found out that you weren't going to have three Hall of Famers in the front five. But starting with Robert, I mean, you know, Robert just went in the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago. Should have been in it earlier, I believe. But he's from Jackson State. And Robert was a big guy. I mean, he was 6'3", 230. And it was a sixth pick in the draft. And his nickname was Dr. Doom.
Mm-hmm.
But he could run 4.6 at least. I mean, he was really fast. He's a generational guy. Sometimes you go back a long time ago and you say, well, these guys couldn't play these days. But Robert is just as big, just as fast as any of the guys today at that time. In fact, he played kind of a middle linebacker for Jackson State. I remember watching the film on him, and people were running the wishbone at that time. And they'd put Robert in the middle, and he would just run to the dive. If the guy didn't have it, he'd run to get the quarterback, and if he pitched it, he'd go get the pitch man. You know, it was obvious what kind of player he was, but his effort was phenomenal. I told this story to every team that I've ever coached. Some of them didn't know Robert Brazil. They knew he was in the Hall of Fame, but when I went to watch the film, because I was coaching the linebackers my first year in the NFL with the Oilers, and so I wanted to watch the players I was going to coach, and so Robert was one of them. And so I watched the film from the year before, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'd never seen, and I'd coached in high school and college, and I thought everybody played hard, and they played as hard as they could. Robert played harder than everybody I'd ever seen. Not because he was faster, bigger and faster than everybody. He could go through what I called a mental barrier of he was going to go after the football. If it looked like three guys were going to make the tackle, he never slowed down. If all three of them missed the tackle, he made it. He was phenomenal in that he played an outside linebacker, but he was around the football on almost every play. I mean, almost every play you could say making the tackle, in on the tackle, or breaking down right around the pile. I mean, I probably hadn't seen anybody since that could do that. But he's second on the Oilers team history, Oilers and Titans team history in tackles now.
Hmm.
He has the second all-time most tackles of anybody. You know, they carried on the Oilers to the Titans, so all the records are still there. He still has the second most tackles ever. Now, he's playing an outside linebacker. Now, you can see a middle linebacker or in a 3-4, one of the two inside backers being able to get to the football because you're in the middle all the time. But he was always on one side and could get to the football. And so that just shows you what he could do.
Yeah, and that's a 10-year career. I mean, which is a phenomenal career for the NFL. But we're not saying he wasn't playing for 16 years or.
No. Yeah, but I went to Robert after I watched the film because I was going to coach him in Houston. I went to his house. I went to Robert and I said, Robert, I mean, I've never seen anybody play as hard as you play. I said, how do you do that? And he looked me right in the eye and he said, Coach, I practice that. And I said, what? I mean, how can you? So we go to practice, and sure enough, I mean, every play that's full speed. Now, you don't go full speed every play in practice. I mean, you'd kill somebody if they had to go full speed 2 hours, at a time. But every drill or every part of practice that was full speed, he went full speed. I mean, he never stopped. We had the running backs, Earl Campbell, they had to run, the coach made him run at least 20 yards down the field every play. He ran 20 yards with him trying to get the ball out. Once he got to the ball, then he'd just stay with him. And then he'd jog back to the huddle in time to run the next play. And then when we were in drills where we just had the front seven playing, he would stand back and be the free safety and run to the ball. He wasn't part of the drill, but he'd run to the ball. So he did something over and beyond. That's what I've always found out about great players or players that do so much more. That's what they do. They practice doing so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way he was. And it helped me as a coach because I could coach people into playing a little bit harder than they could before. And I still believe that. I still believe there's another level of how hard you play. They say playoffs is another level. I think how hard you play is, and you can play, there's another level to it, because every player that I've been around, and most coaches are the same way, they think their guys play hard all the time, or they think they're playing really hard all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at, if you look at the tape now and you see a guy run into the ball and he speeds up, he wasn't running full speed.
Mm-hmm.
They don't realize that. And also, your brain, when you look at something, you sometimes decide, well, I can't get there. And so you're not going as hard as you would, like Robert would. Robert was going to get there every play. And we've seen it with the Polamalus of the world, you remember him. Guys that play with their hair on fire,
mm-hmm.
Everybody can. They're not willing to, but everyone can, and they can be taught to do better. It's at least that's what I learned from coaching Robert. And I tried to carry on that throughout my history as coaching in the league, and I think it's helped. But Robert was really the guy that brought it to my attention that you could do that. Besides being a great player, I mean, he and Lawrence Taylor, certainly Lawrence Taylor's looked at as one of the greats, but Robert was right there with him at the same time. He made more tackles than anybody. It was amazing from that position.
That is amazing. Yeah, when you mentioned Polamalu, let's not talk about his hair on fire. He's made a lot of money on endorsements off that hair.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, he's proud of that hair, and he should be.
Yeah, it's some good hair.
Yep.
All right, and then coaching Bethea and Culp, is there anything, Culp being more of an interior lineman, right, and Elvin was the defensive end in the 3-4
Elvin was an end, but he was our leading tackler 1 year. Elvin was from defensive end, which is another amazing deal. But we didn't play the old 3-4 two gap. We stunted him, or he's moving all the time, and that's what he did well. Elvin was about 6'2", about 260, could really run, really agile. Came from North Carolina A&T and played guard in college. And I think that's amazing. The guy played guard in college, offensive guard, and he's in the Hall of Fame as a defensive lineman. Just shows you what kind of athlete he was.
Mm.
He still holds the team record, 16 sacks in one season. Again, that's through the Oilers and the – now, they didn't count sacks until 1982, but he had 16, which is the best of any player with the Oilers or – the Titans in one season.
Yeah, 16 in a 14-game season.
Yes.
Also.
Yes, that's another part of it.
Which is just, it's crazy to even think about 16 in a 14-game season. But We will get to another feat that I thought was even more impressive.
Yeah, he was a third-round pick. He's number 61, 61st player in the draft. And he was 2 years older than I was, and he still is. So, yeah, and we talked about that a little bit. But, I mean, it doesn't matter your age as long as you can teach them what they need to get done and be able to let them do it the way they need to do it the best. He did holler to the tower one time. We talked about earlier, Wade's coaching his ass off, but that's the kind of guy he was. He was a fun guy. He was a always upbeat kind of guy and certainly a great athlete and certainly deserved to be in the Hall of Fame, which he is.
Well, yeah, one of the members of the 100 sack club finishing his career with 105. Not all, you know, officially counted, but as far as looking back and retrospect, they counted all those sacks up. He's got 105. He was four-time All-Pro and eight-time Pro Bowler. So, but all three of these guys, all deserving, but none of them were inducted until the 2000s.
Right. It took a while. It took a while to realize, what kind of players they were, I guess. But Curly Culp was the other one. You know, he was Arizona State. And he was a second-round pick. He was at that time 31st pick in the draft, which, you know, they didn't have as many teams when he went in. So 6'1", 265, right in there. But he was the NCAA wrestling champ at Arizona State. He pinned the guy in the national championship. He pinned the guy in 45 seconds to win the national championship, a heavyweight wrestler. Anybody that knows wrestling, that's hard to do. Especially the heavyweights, to get them down and get them pinned like that. Now, the interesting thing about him was he came to the Oilers in a trade. He played for the Chiefs when they won the Super Bowl, and they traded Curly Culp for a guy named John Matusak. And John Matusak was, I think he was like 6'8". He was a big, big guy that the Chiefs liked in their defensive line. If you remember Buck Buchanan and those guys, they had all big guys, and Curly was a shorter, really good player, obviously. Shorter guy. They liked a bigger, taller, big guy. So they traded for John Matusak, who the Oilers had, and they gave up another draft choice. Well, the draft choice was Robert Brazil. So it was a pretty good trade in that they ended out with Robert Brazil and Curly Culp, two Hall of Famers, and John Matusak, I don't think, played much longer, a couple of years, but obviously not near the player those two guys were. So a great trade by the Oilers there.
Yeah, what a trade. It's right. Franchise-changing type trade. So there were a few guys that, just thrown out there, if you wanted to mention anything on the other side of the ball, you didn't coach directly. I think people might be interested just to kind of know, just in general, when you're on the other side of the ball from a player, whether you're position coach, whether you're a coordinator, just because you're coaching on an NFL team, it doesn't mean that you have really strong. You try to get to know these guys, but it's just some guys you're just not around as much. There's a lot of players on the team. Did you make a point? Were you trying to reach out to guys you didn't know? I mean, there's a lot of faces that change. There's just by nature, there's going to be some guys you don't have great relationships with, right?
Yeah, I mean, the size of the team was smaller then. We didn't have the practice squads, stuff like that. And, of course, Bum, or my dad, he was big on family, so we got to know each other pretty well that way. Now, knowing each other doesn't mean, Curly Culp, we're talking about Curly Culp, when I first started coaching Curly, he wouldn't even say hello to me. So that was a little bit of a challenge to start with. Maybe because I was a young coach, and my personality, but the first year I was there and I was coaching linebackers, he never said hello to me. And after a while, I'd walk by him in the hall and say, "Hey, Curly, how you doing today?" And he'd go, "Huh?" So I'd mess with him a little bit that way. But the next year, my dad called me in and said, "Hey, Wade, you're coaching the defensive line." I said, "Well, that's good, because Curly and I really get along well." But we did. We ended up, because Curly was a really smart guy, really smart. Even though he played nose, it doesn't take a brilliant guy to play nose guard, but he knew the blocking combinations and things like that. And then he would get double teamed some, and he knew, and I'd tell him, I said, "Look, Curly," he'd say, "I'm getting double teamed, I don't like playing nose guard." I'd say, "Well, if they're double teaming you, Curly, then somebody on the defense is free." But he knew it. So and he could do about it. He could rush the passer too. For he wasn't tall, but he could. He's such great lateral movement and so strong. And then in those days, it wasn't illegal to hit a guy in the head. And the first play of the game, he would try to knock the center's head off. I mean, literally. Hmm. He would hit him with an elbow right across the helmet as hard as he could the first play of the game. And all of them knew it. And we had a lot of fumbles on the first play of the game because they had watched the film. You could tell which teams were watching the film because he was going to haul off and hit them. Yeah, he did that about as good as anybody I've ever seen. But they outlawed that, which they should have.
Sure, sure. Speaking of the other side of the ball, not every guy will touch on, I think, that you haven't coached directly, but one of them I think worth mentioning for sure is Earl Campbell, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of the relationship between Bum, Earl, yourself. You guys are kind of joked that you're brothers.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, again, Earl obviously was such a great player. Of course, everybody in Texas, I mean, state of Texas, knew about him. I mean, in high school, he had over 200 yards a game in every playoff game. He was already a kind of a legend when he went to University of Texas. And then to go to University of Texas and be the Heisman Trophy winner solidified, what he did, who he was, and everybody knew about him, and he was the number one pick. And we traded to get the number one pick in the draft. That was him, and so, but just a great guy. When we got him, he didn't act like, he owned the world or was better than everybody, which he was. But just a down-to-earth guy, good guy. And Earl and my dad not only drafted him, but he took him in as part of the family, kind of. He looked after Earl when he could. I mean, he bragged on him a lot, which he should have. I mean, Earl was all everything. He was just a down-to-earth guy that I talked to him not too long ago when they named the field after he and Ricky Williams. He's still revered today, and he should be and will be forever, I guess. But if you're ever around him, you realize why. Not only his talent, but how he utilized his talent. And it was amazing in the dressing room before a game. It'd start going around the dressing room, Earl's ready. Earl's ready to play. Everybody started getting excited. They said, Earl's ready to play. Knowing that Earl was ready, watch out. Like I said, I mean, he did so many things in college, but then in pro football, he was MVP his first year. I mean, the guy's phenomenal. And the next year and the next year. I just can't say enough good things about him as a person, number one. But as a player, I mean, I said it before, we were standing on the other side of the line of scrimmage. In practice, it looked like a lawnmower, the grass coming out the back when he's running through the line of scrimmage. And you could only see his shoulders and his knees, because he went right, we called it right under a tabletop as he's running through the line of scrimmage when you're standing on the other side looking at him. And that's why so many guys, the defensive backs, just tried to jump out of the way and jump on the back of him if they could, because he was like a locomotive going through there.
Well, a lot of defenders can attest to that played throughout those years for sure. I've actually, the iconic play where he, lowers the head on, was it Isaiah Robertson?
Yep.
I was actually with Bum at one point and Earl, where I actually heard him kind of just talk about that and say how he wasn't happy that it, because he had so much respect for, I mean, Robertson in his own right was a great player. That clip comes up a lot, and Earl kind of felt bad about, the fact that
Isaiah was at the Angelo Clinic one year and talked to him, and he said, Wade, he said, I was, I think he was a Pro Bowler, two or three times, and he said, the only thing people remember about me is Earl Campbell running over me. He said, that's the only thing. He said, that's the only bad thing. They don't remember, that I made the Pro Bowl and was a pretty good player. And he was a good player, so, yeah. But couldn't get in Earl's way because he would run through you for sure.
Well, one future Hall of Famer on the offensive side of the ball that you coached, but I'll bet briefly, Steve Largent was actually a cut from the Oilers coming out of Tulsa.
Yeah, Steve Largent was, I want to say, I don't want to say it, but I mean, he's kind of my guy. He, in those days, coaches still do. I mean, we'd evaluate players. Once the season was over, you start evaluating players and give grades on them. Well, the way we did it was we went to the school that they played at, and we looked at all the players on their team and all the players on the teams that they were playing and give evaluations. Bum didn't like to just say, you know, Wade, you look at all the linebackers. I looked at all the linebackers, but I looked at all D linemen, all the offensive players, and graded each one of them. And one of my schools was Tulsa, and I went to Tulsa, and I graded Steve Largent, and I thought he was a really good player. And so the draft came around. I got in the third round, and they said, well, we need a receiver. And I said, well, I think Steve Largent. You know? and for whatever reason, we picked Steve Largent. And I'm sure one of the scouts and somebody else was behind it too, certainly. It wasn't just me. But anyway, we picked Steve Largent. He came in, came to training camp, and he's starting to practice, and we're going through training camp. It comes up that we got a cut day. It's the night before, and so Bum brings us all in and says, we need to cut a receiver. The receiver coach and the offensive coaches, you know, who do we need to cut? And they said Steve Largent, which surprised me a little bit, but I hadn't been watching. You know, I'm coaching the D-line or linebackers, and, you know, I'm not watching the secondary and who they're playing against and so forth. But I was kind of disappointed they were going to cut Steve Largent. And they had a receiver named Otis Taylor who was Pro Bowl receiver for the Chiefs, but we got him and he was still coming off injury. Anyway, they said, okay, we want to cut Steve Largent. Well, Richie Pettibone, our secondary coach, stood up and said, Bum, he said, I don't think we ought to cut that kid because the offense had just said that. And normally on defense, you don't, you know, whatever they want to do, they do. And, but Richie, I'll say this for him, he stood up and said, hey, he said, that kid catches everything. He said, we can't cover him. He said, you can't, he catches behind his head, you know, everywhere. You know, I mean, he just made a big play for him. And so Bum said, well, okay. He said, well, offensive guys, what do you think again? And they said, well, Otis Taylor, once he comes back, you know, we'll have him and Billy Johnson and Kenny Burrow, and we had some receivers. Mm-hmm. And they thought Otis Taylor would come back and be a better receiver than Steve Largent, long story short, I guess. So they said, okay, we'll cut Steve Largent. Well, in those days, you had what they call recall waivers. In other words, you cut somebody and people picked him up, then you could recall him and then trade him. Mm-hmm. So there were like, I think there were three teams, maybe more. Steve could tell you probably how many there were. There were like three or four teams probably that claimed him. And so we recalled him and then we traded him to Seattle for a third round pick. We picked him in the third round. We got a third round pick for him. Now, I can't tell you who the third round pick was the next year, but it wasn't Steve. It wasn't a Hall of Famer, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
So anyway, that's how Steve Largent got to Seattle, and like I say, we had Billy White Shoes and Kenny Burrow and Renfro. We had some good receivers, but Steve Largent was a great one too.
Well, I mean, we all know that the draft and even evaluating players in your own building is not an exact science, and there's stories like that. What I always kind of loved that Bum never shied away from telling that story, just to say, hey, I cut Steve Largent. You know, he was upfront about it. We know that there's stories across the league of those sort of things happening, or guys just not getting drafted at all and becoming great players, or guys getting drafted in the sixth round, you know, a la Tom Brady. And it's sure. An inexact science, and you know, but what could have been, right? You know, if you would have held on to him and had him as a weapon as well.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Obviously, we did well, but anytime you have a Pro Bowler, a Hall of Famer, they're probably going to do a little bit better.
and just a couple other guys on the Oilers that are really more known for playing with the Raiders. You had Kenny Stabler, and you had Dave Casper, the tight end, as well. Anything to comment about on those guys?
Oh yeah, yeah. Casper was a really brilliant guy. I mean, I had the offensive coaches tell me, but he knew what everybody's. He knew the tackle, he knew the guard, he knew the running back, he knew on every play, he knew what they were going to do. And, of course, he knew what he was going to do. For you football people, I guess, he would sometimes be blocking the outside linebacker on a play, and he would, if he knew the linebacker wasn't rushing, he would step down and hit the five technique and then block the guy. So he helped the tackle and then would block his man. I mean, things like that. And he was a great blocker. People don't realize that, I'm sure. I mean, he's in the Hall of Fame as a receiver, obviously, but as a tight end. But he was a really great blocker. In fact, when we brought him in, in the middle of the season, and we went to a two tight end ace formation, one back, two tight ends, 12 personnel. But anyway, we went to that formation. Not a whole lot of people were running at it at that time, and most everybody was two back. He came in, and Earl Campbell had three straight 200-yard rushing games. Three straight 200-yard rushing games. And you know, I mean, from coaching offense, I mean, they, with the two tight ends and one back, they just audibled away from the strong safety and run to the weak side. So whichever they'd run towards, Casper or Mike Barber.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were good blockers. And Earl was a great runner, but that way we were always running away from the rotation. So people that know football a little bit. So that's what they did. And Dave was just, he'd sit back in the back of the plane, and when we'd be on a road trip, different than these days, he'd be sitting in the back of the plane, sitting on the flight attendant's seat back there, and he'd have his Jack Daniels in his hand, and he'd play his guitar. He'd have somebody hold his Jack Daniels, and he'd be playing his guitar in the back, which is a lot different than these days.
Absolutely, yeah.
but a really great player.
Well, of course, nicknamed the Ghost because of his name, but he actually, you know, you mentioned the blocking aspect. I mean, well, he has one of the more, you don't really see this anymore, one of the more unique college careers. So I was reading at Notre Dame in 1972, he was honorable mention All-American as a offensive tackle. And in 1973, he was All-American for the 1973 National Championship team and their offensive MVP as a tight end.
Yeah.
So I mean, he actually, it doesn't surprise me that he really understood what was going on inside, you know, being a smart football player. If you could play offensive line, or even as a coach, be in the offensive line room and then kind of branch out, I think just benefits you kind of learning it from the inside out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was him. And then you talked about Snake, right?
The Snake. Stabler.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing guy. First day of practice that he came. We traded for him, and he came first day of training camp.
Okay. Traded quarterbacks, right?
Yeah, Pastorini for Stabler.
Which is rare.
Yeah. First day of training camp, he comes to training camp. Now, in those days, we didn't have an off season because some of the players worked or whatever, but you didn't see him from after the season until training camp, which is obviously much different than we do now. So getting a new player, he hadn't had the playbook. He didn't have – it's the first day of camp now. He didn't have the playbook, background, anything of that. You know, they just put in the plays in the night before meeting. And he didn't know any of the receivers and had not thrown a football, had not picked up a football, he said, from the time his last game the year before. First day he picked up a football was in training camp, okay? First drill, we're running 7-on-7. Okay, we had a good defense. I mean, those days we won a lot of games, went to the AFC Championship, you know, had Brazil Cup. You know, we had a really good secondary. I mean, we had a really good defensive team. And the first day of training camp, he threw every ball in 7-on-7 was complete.
Mm-hmm.
Every ball. I mean, that doesn't happen now. It never happens. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I got out there and, you know, he completed a pass and he completed another pass and he just... And he didn't know any of the receivers. I mean, he obviously knew what route they were going to run, I guess, but had great timing. And then after a while, you know, a lot of coaches would come to training camp, high school coaches, and other coaches would come to our training camp. And so I'd be over with them when we were doing 7-on-7. I'd be standing over there, and if I knew the coaches or whatever, I'd say, hey, I bet you a dollar the next pass is right here, which is right at chest level where you can – reach your hands out, but you don't have to reach it. I said, I'll bet you the next pass is right here. I said, I'll bet you a dollar, next pass is going to be right here. Because I knew almost every pass was not completed, but it was right in stride where the guy was going. And that's why he should have been in the Hall of Fame, because he could throw like that. He was so easy throwing like that. And he was great at slot formation, because that's what he played at Oakland. So you put him in the slot, he knew the two receivers. Now, the other thing he could do, which I can't show here, I guess, but he would get in the middle of throwing the ball and then change direction and throw it to somebody else.
Mm.
I mean, at the last second, that And the other thing he did, and I've never seen another quarterback do it, if the defensive back fell down, he'd throw it to that guy. If anybody, if for some reason the defensive back, you know, you see guys fall down and, you know, they throw it to somebody else. I mean, they don't see it. And that's why we called him Snake. He was all seeing. He could see everything.
Hmm.
If somebody fell down or, you know, he'd throw it to that guy. I'm just like that. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen, and I don't think I'll see it again.
Well, some guys just have that great vision. I don't know that you can teach it, or Tony Romo had great field vision, you know, kind of see the whole picture, the whole thing, as opposed to narrowing in on those tiny little spots. But, you know, Stabler was posthumously elected in 2016, but one thing I didn't know, he was the fastest to win 100 games as a starting quarterback. He did it in 150 games, which had beat Johnny Unitas's mark at that time. And since then, it was only Bradshaw, Montana, and Brady have reached 100 wins more quickly. So
yeah,
it's pretty good company right there.
Yeah, and the other thing about him, because we played against him, and this was common with coaches at the time, was don't get ahead of him early. If you're going to beat Stabler, score with no time left, because he was a two-minute whiz. In the last 2 minutes, if he had the ball and he was behind, you were beat. Mm. It was a common saying between the coaches that, hey, don't get ahead of him, especially if you get ahead of him early, he's gonna start throwing it. Because teams weren't throwing it that much in those days.
Mm.
I mean, everybody was a running game and keep running the ball and throw it some. And, you know, they'd throw it 20 times, but they didn't throw it 40 times. But if he got behind, he's going to be throwing the ball. And if he's throwing the ball, it's going to be accurate. And he's going to move it. And we said that, and then we ended up getting him. I was glad of that.
Well, yeah, he's going to find a way to win, even if he had to fumble it forward to his guy, yeah. Dave Casper, the old holy roller play.
Those two guys together, that's right.
So the Snake actually followed you guys when Bum got the head job in New Orleans, and then while you were there, you guys in the second round picked an outside linebacker by the name of Ricky Jackson, another guy who in that 100-sack club, 128 sacks over his career, but again, second rounder, not even a first round pick. What are your memories of Ricky and when you were thinking about picking him?
Yeah, we needed linebackers. We had six linebackers that we liked, okay? And we picked Ricky in the second round with the 51st pick. But all five linebackers that we liked, five other ones are all gone. So we had to take him because that was the linebacker we liked, one of the six. He was the only one left, okay? Which turned out great for us because Ricky played for Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, and their number one guy, it was a guy named Hugh Green, was picked in the first round by Tampa. And everybody thought he was a great player, and he was a good, really good player in college. So we thought we were getting a kind of an undersized outside backer, 6'2", 220. First day he came in, he was 6'2", 243. And he whipped every tight end we had, and we had some good tight ends. He was bigger and stronger, and he was like a cat. I mean, you couldn't cut him. People tried to cut him. He had no chance. The first day, we knew we had a great player. I didn't know he was going to be in the Hall of Fame that quickly, but he wasn't the guy we thought we were getting. We thought we were getting a pretty good outside backer that was 220 pounds. We had 240. Hugh Green played and was a decent player, but not a Hall of Famer like Ricky. The guy that was their number one linebacker, Ricky, ended out a whole lot better in Pro Bowl.
Is Ricky Jackson the best player you've ever coached out of Pitt?
The best player out of Pitt? He's the best outside backer I coached out of Pitt, that's
okay.
For sure.
All right, because you have coached another player from Pitt that's pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yeah, Ricky was, I guess, we couldn't believe that the only guy left was the guy that was better than all the six guys, five guys in front of him. But he certainly was, and they proved out to be.
Wow. You were also on that team with, you know, one of the few kickers to make the Hall of Fame over time. I believe he's got his own podcast, the Great Dane podcast, but Morton Anderson.
Yeah, Morton, I think it's an interesting story. I mean, my dad said we need a kicker when we went to New Orleans. He said we need a kicker, and Harold Richardson, who was coaching with us, coached special teams. My dad came and said, Wade, you and Harold, find me a kicker. Now, we hadn't been on the road. We didn't. We didn't have film on them. We didn't have anything basically, and so we was trying to find out about a kicker, and it's hard to watch on film anyway, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, we actually looked up all the stats. We looked at Michigan State, that's where he was. Every kickoff was out of the end zone. I mean, he was bombing it. We knew he had a good leg. And we checked his field goal stats, and we went to my dad and said, well, all we know is this guy from Michigan State, Morton Anderson, pretty good kicker. And so we ended up taking him. When we took him, they were worried about his green card. We didn't know, he's from Denmark, just played for Michigan State. We didn't have any background on him or anything. And all of a sudden, we were afraid that they wouldn't be able to keep his green card and stay in the United States, and we just drafted a guy. But then once he got there, I mean, gee, he kicked it out of the end zone no matter how far he moved the ball back. I mean, I've never seen a leg like that, that's for sure.
Well, one of the all-time greats, for sure. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. You know, we'll move on going forward, kind of touching some more of these guys that just were phenomenal players that you had the privilege, I guess, to coach over the years.
Oh, yeah.
Until next time.
All righty.